Hoffman.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In her new book, Passed On, African-American Mourning Stories, A Memorial, author Carla Holloway writes, no culture bases so much of its identity on the persistent rehearsal of commemorative conduct as does African-America. In this hour, the African-American way of death and a little told story of black funerals in America. We begin this hour with the escalating violence in the Middle East. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said today that his government will establish buffer zones to protect Israelis from Palestinian attackers. Earlier, I spoke with the Christian Science Monitor's Cameron Barr in Jerusalem and asked him about the military and political context of Sharon's speech.
Well, militarily, this conflict is entering another new grim phase. The most notable event has been a series of attacks by Palestinian militants, really soldiers, really guerrillas, against the Israeli military. And I think in the past 8 days, Israel has lost 13 soldiers, which is quite a high number. That is one of the things that's creating a lot of upset and demoralization within Israel, both at the popular level and also at the political level. So the prime minister is encountering criticism not just from the left, but also from the right, which feels like the prime minister needs to act more sternly, more aggressively against the Palestinians.
So how did the prime minister address this crisis in his speech?
Well, first of all, it was a speech that was designed to promote a sense of unity, a sense of pride. He asked for patience. He asked for calm. He asked them to stand firm and united. It was a pep talk in a political sense. But he also came up with a concrete measure, but it's very undefined. He talked about buffer zones to separate, to achieve what he called a security separation between the two sides. This is not a new idea. It's new if he's endorsing it and if he really plans to implement it in force. And it raises a lot of questions. It's been much discussed here because of the practical implications of trying to separate two peoples who are as intertwined as the Israelis and the Palestinians are legion.
And he says he wants to prevent total war. Did he say how?
Well, no. He didn't say how. He spoke mainly to his Israeli audience, much more than to his international audience. And I think, interestingly, he also addressed directly the Palestinians. He asked them to consider whether they would, and this is a quote, continue to follow those who lead you to ruin, destruction, and despair. And this may be an extension of his policy of declaring Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, to be irrelevant. Perhaps he's trying to lead the Palestinians himself. I can tell you the early reaction to this is not very favorable from the Palestinian side. Nonetheless, I think he wants to seem as if he's open to what he calls, and he used this phrase many times in the speech, painful compromise for peace. But I think he's virtually alone in thinking that the Palestinians can enforce a ceasefire on the terms that he demands, and the Palestinians and Ariel Sharon will have much to say to each other if they should ever come to the peace table.
On their side, the Palestinians say they have entered a new phase of the Intifada and the Palestinian resistance. Tell us about that.
I'm not sure it's such a new phase. They are finding now that with the appearance of some dissension within the Israeli ranks, they're achieving a kind of unity of purpose that they haven't had in a while. And also the military successes, as the Palestinians would put it, of the past few days has also given Palestinians something to cheer about. The destruction of a Merkava Israeli tank, which Hezbollah failed to do in the many, many years that the Israelis were occupying what they called their security zone in South Lebanon. And then the killing of six Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint in the West Bank a few nights ago. These are seen as great successes on the Palestinian side. But it remains to be seen just exactly what the Israelis will do to counteract this. In the past 24 hours, I think the Israelis have killed nearly one Palestinian per hour. It's a new phase in a very negative sense, too, where the level of violence is much more militarized. This is really now a contest between a kind of ragtag, not very well-trained group of guerrilla units on the Palestinian side, and the most powerful military in the Middle East on the Israeli side.
One of the Palestinian leaders, a leader of the Fatah faction, Marwan Barghouti, was quoted in the Times as saying that our new tactic is not to take violence within Israel proper or against civilians, but to fight on the West Bank against the civilians in settlements and against military targets. Now, is this an effort to sort of get right with international opinion if they can somehow stop the terror attacks within Israel and shift to guerrilla warfare?
It has to be said that isn't new. Fatah, which is the core of Palestinian politics, the faction founded by Yasser Arafat, has always felt that armed struggle was legitimate and most legitimate when conducted against Israeli soldiers and settlers, that's to say, people outside of Israel proper. It's not to say that Fatah militants have never committed blatantly terrorist actions against Israeli civilians, because they have. But I think that Marwan Barghouti is feeling satisfied that these recent operations have proven to be so successful. And he's now, I think, trying to capitalize on that and also, as you suggest, put himself on the right side of international opinion.
Was this ship that was seized a few weeks ago from Iran carrying weapons to the Palestinian Authority, was that linked, the weapons on that ship, were they to be part of this new tack of this expanded guerrilla tactic?
Conceivably, yes. It remains to be conclusively proved to the public just what the provenance of those weapons were and who was transporting them and why. I mean, those weapons were apparently intended to go through the Suez Canal on the way into the Mediterranean so that they could be offloaded at the coast of Gaza and then floated in. And the idea that a ship absolutely full of weapons could pass through the Suez Canal without the knowledge of the Egyptians is something that beggars the belief of even, you know, diplomats around here who've seen it all.
You are raising what question there, or what question do they raise about this, then?
Well, there could be one of two possibilities. One is that this ship and its crew intended to bribe their way completely through the Suez. And the other possibility, which I think is absolutely a worst-case scenario in the mind of the American government, is that these weapons were going to go through the Suez Canal with the connivance of Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president.
Finally, the dissent among Israeli military reservists, 270 have now signed a letter refusing to serve in the territories on moral ground. Has Sharon or the army responded to that, and how has the public reacted to that?
Sharon was clearly interested in addressing this issue tonight, and he spoke harshly about enemies who are misperceiving or misunderstanding what's going on among Israelis. It's also having a ripple effect within society here, and that Peace Now, the Israeli peace movement, has been able to draw thousands of people to its demonstrations. And then most recently, a group of dovish but nonetheless influential retired generals and intelligence officers has come out with a position saying that they will campaign for unilateral withdrawal from the territories, including many settlements. And this, of course, is a position that Sharon does not endorse. It's a criticism of him, and it's a reflection overall of a sense among Israelis that the government has lost control of the security policy, of how it's handling the conflict, so that there are now Israelis coming to the fore, whether from the left or from the center or from the establishment itself, saying, let's consider this new idea.
Cameron Barr is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Black funerals tend to be louder, more spirited, and more of a performance than those of white America. Why is this? Is it, as tonight's guest, Carla Holloway, says, because, quote, some notion of racial memory and racial realization is mediated through the veil of death? What are your culture's burial rituals? Or, if you are African American, does Carla Holloway's description resonate with your experiences? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me from Durham, North Carolina, is Carla Holloway, author of Passed On, African American Mourning Stories, A Memorial. She is a professor of English and dean of humanities and social sciences at Duke University. Welcome, Dean Holloway.
Thank you very much.
With us from the studios of WRNI in Providence is tonight's guest news analyst, Lewis Gordon, director of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. Welcome, Professor Gordon.
Ah, thank you.
Well, Carla Holloway, your book has an affecting chapter, to say the least of it, called How We Die. How have Black Americans died in the 20th century?
Well, one of the things that I look at in this book is the way that we have died that have, and we as a collective sense there, that has some relationship to our color. That, although someone said at a conference I was at earlier today that birth is the one way to assure death, one of the things that happens with African Americans is that their color, our color marks us as vulnerable. And so whether it's medical malpractice or lynchings or riots and rebellions or being marked for a different kind of treatment, Black Americans have come to some realization of the way that we are received in America through the veil of death.
And, of course, that death sometimes has been horrifically administered.
Absolutely it has. If we think about the way the century began with the legacy of the 19th century's practice of lynching, and the century continued this practice of lynching, actually the 20th century, throughout the century. Well, this kind of mark for Black life meant that there was going to be a vulnerability that we could do nothing about other than to live very carefully. And when these moments of death came to our community, to find something in those moments that would bring us back together as a community and give us some resilience to move on.
You quote, and I will quote here because it's a document that I think everybody needs to hear, something from the Vicksburg, Mississippi Evening Post, a news account of a lynching in 1905. And I quote it just because the word lynching does not convey what happened in the South. And it does not convey really also the connection to the Black funeral industry. Anyway, here's this passage. When the two Negroes were captured, they were forced to hold out their hands while one finger at a time was chopped off. The fingers were distributed as souvenirs. The ears of the murderers were cut off. Holbert was beaten severely. His skull was fractured, and one of his eyes, knocked out with a stick, hung by a shred from the socket. A large corkscrew was bored into the flesh of the man and woman in the arms, legs, and body, and then pulled out, the spirals tearing out big pieces of raw, quivering flesh every time it was withdrawn.
It's chilling to hear that read out loud. It was certainly chilling to write it and to find it. But you've got to wonder what a newspaper was doing printing that kind of detail, if not in one sense, certainly not to warn off this kind of treatment for African America. And in my view of it, I think it was in one sense titillating for the readership of the Vicksburg, Mississippi Evening Post.
And of course, the connection to the Black Undertaker is sort of clear, isn't it? I mean, Black Undertakers had to deal with people who were disfigured, and they had to become very good at restoring them.
Black undertakers have told me that they are better at restorative arts than their colleagues in their white businesses, specifically because of the background that we have had in trying to bring some visual to the Black body that would be, frankly, palatable for the audience. Mm. Although I've also got to say that on some occasions, like the lynching of Emmett Till, Emmett Till's mother insisted that the casket be left open and his body not repaired so that they could see, she said, what they had done to her son.
Mm-hmm. and you have a photograph in the book of the funeral of Emmett Till, massive crowd in Chicago. We're coming right back, and Lewis Gordon, I apologize, we'll come right back with you. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
You.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the African-American way of death in the 20th century. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests are Carla Holloway, author of Passed On, African-American Mourning Stories, A Memorial, and our guest news analyst, Lewis Gordon, director of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. Carla Holloway, I wonder if you would read something from your introduction for us.
I will. When I started working on this book, I had not imagined how this would be connected to me in such a visceral and personal way, that the narrative of Passed On, which invaded my serenity many years ago, well before my son's life took its tragic final turn, would find its articulation in this manner. I do not tell his story for judgment or absolution. I tell it instead because it too has the characteristics of an incident report that is, finally, community property.
Hmm. And this is the violent death of your adopted son, and we will return to that in a moment. Lewis Gordon, Carla Holloway paints death as a release for African Americans, at least in some circumstances in the South under segregation. How does that resonate with you?
Oh, it resonates in many ways. In fact, what Professor Calloway shows is that not only is there a variety of ways in which one can tell a story, but she brings out the illuminating character of what it means to tell it through the African American experience. One thing that comes to mind, for instance, is the stories she tells are filled of death, but not often despair. And what I mean by that is it's something that taps into what the philosopher Nietzsche talked about when he talked about health. He pointed out that we shouldn't think of health as the absence of disease or affliction, but health as the ability to deal with disease and affliction. And in many ways, the way she describes the response of the African-American community, particularly in terms of the evolution of the funeral industry among African-Americans, speaks to this very well. In other words, she points out that it was not simply the profit motive, but also the humanistic motive, the desire to create a place in which, in death, the community can deal with processes of healing in a very healthy way.
Carla Holloway?
I so appreciate your understanding that dimension of the book, Professor Gordon, because this is a book in many ways about resilience, about death, but not despair, as you say so beautifully. One of the things which I'm very clear about now is the way in which the African-American mortician, the funeral directors and morticians, made certain that African-Americans who experienced these ravages of their bodies would have a safe space in which to heal. And in many ways, that space was not only the frame of the Black funeral home itself and our churches, because there was a very close association between minister and mortician, but it was as well the space of the funeral ceremony and the spiritual engagement that allowed and indeed encouraged by the funeral directors.
It struck me as well that you had a very special guide in this book, W.B. Du Bois.
I did.
Not only in terms of his own experiences with the death of his son, but also in many ways the way in which you brought out the doubled world, the double consciousness that is manifested in the two industries. I was thinking, for instance, as you spoke about the skills of the trade, beyond the question of those who died from violent death, the other skill that many Black morticians had was the fact that Black people have a very broad range of how we look.
Color, absolutely.
So even outside of dealing with situations that were terrible situations, just in terms of the mundane, say a person died just from natural causes, mm-hmm. there was still an array of skill that had to be mastered in that context that
one of the
offered
things,
much yeah, to the world.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. One of the things that struck me as I visited with funeral directors and went to the conventions were the vats of cosmetics in every hue you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And the stories they told me about how important those cosmetics were because of the idea and the issues of color in our community and the folk belief and indeed the actuality that black folk get darker with death. And that appearance of how we looked during life was something that they had to replicate and felt very responsible to making sure that that restorative art restored mom to the color that she was.
To lighten her, as you say in the book. Violent death, of course, continues to be among the leading causes of death, premature mortality for African-American young men. And you, Carla Holloway, have had a personal experience with that. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I can say what I said in the book, and I took my son's life from the moment when we found that he had been killed, trying to escape from prison, and found myself in the midst of a project that I had been working on for about 10 years and writing about what I was to experience in the most intimate and, frankly, the most horrific way. And at that point, or at least at the point when I found I could come back to this project. Indeed, the project pulled me back to it as a healing, I believe, that the experience of my child's death was not unlike the young men that I had been writing about throughout the story, that their vulnerability to die before the age of 25, African-American youth, males especially, is a very exquisite factor in their being every year of their lives.
The consciousness that this could happen to them.
Absolutely, and that's the consciousness that parents live with, and that's a kind of protectiveness and worry we have over our children.
Let's take a call. Paydar is on the line. Welcome. Paydar?
Yes.
Welcome.
Goody, thank you. Hearing this, it brings me back to my youth when I was 13 or 14, and I had read a story here in New England about a lynching in the South. As I said to your interviewer, that I either was a precocious child or an oversensitive one, and that hopefully we could have all been that oversensitive at those times. And I've carried it all this way since 1947, with the death of our black souls in this country, and it's shameful that we happen to be white people, and I don't know whether they can ever forgive us for any of that. And with all of that, I'm crestfallen at what has happened recently in Georgia with the crematory, and it bothers the dickens out of me.
Well,
I wonder if they could comment on that.
It horrifies everybody, but that doesn't have, of course, exclusive application to African Americans, right? That white people were also their bodies were also sent to that crematorium.
Right.
But Carla Holloway would respond about.
Oh, it's a stunningly horrific story. And you're right; there is no real cultural context to this except perhaps the note that of those bodies that were sent to the Tri-State Crematorium, very few were black because black people do not cremate in the same numbers. Maybe somewhere between 8 to 10% of black bodies in the United States are cremated. So that's a dimension of that story that is frankly not really relevant to its horror.
Sure. Sure. Paydar raises a larger question. We can only touch on it, but we don't want to skirt it, and that is forgiveness. That many white Americans hearing about lynching, hearing about slavery, hearing about the way blacks have died in the 20th century, feel they need to be forgiven. Is there forgiveness? Is that possible, do you think?
Well, I think... I'm sorry.
Please, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. As one of the things I was thinking through as I read through your book, for some reason, I kept thinking through Dante's Inferno. And as we know, the message at the end of the Inferno, you know, when Virgil takes, you know, takes Dante to the point where he witnesses an individual so consumed by revenge that he's sitting there in this frozen hell chewing on the skull of his enemy. And at that point, Dante is released from this consuming desire for revenge and begins to look forward. One of the issues with forgiveness is that in the end, it's therapeutic in the end for a community in the sense that one needs to be able to deal with the history, but one has to also be able to move forward.
Absolutely.
The main thing, the problem in the United States is that there has been a sneaky deal of demanding historical amnesia with forgiveness, and we need to find a way to have both that memory and forgiveness at the same time.
Mm. Our memory and our remembering is a way towards forgiveness, I think. There is a version of that reconciliation that you mentioned in the funeral sermon at the end of the book that quotes James Baldwin's preacher in another country that says, at a funeral service, don't let it make you bitter. Try to understand. The world's already bitter enough. We got to try to be better than the world. And in many ways, I think that is the spirit of Black America, to both forgive and remember and use those things in tandem to make us stronger.
Mm. As you mentioned that, one of the things also that I was thinking about while reading the book is the role of the blues.
Yes.
You know, I've been thinking about the blues a lot of late, and it struck me that the blues is not simply a response to affliction, but the blues is a recognition of the complexity of life. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, this aspect of the blues, particularly in terms of that earlier question about death as liberation, the idea that to recognize that life is suffering, but in it, at the same time, is that one should not fear death, but understand it.
Mm.
And in many ways, I began to think through also in terms of some of the African elements that have contributed to this view that enabled African Americans to have a healthy response to their historic situation.
Mm.
And that element is the view that ultimately, in the end, death brings one into accounts that are positive.
Mm. Let's take a call, Lewis, from Rachel. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
I was calling with something in response to what Carla Holloway was saying about reports on the lynchings and the detail that they went into.
Mm-hmm.
She was saying that she suspects in a certain sense that it was they went into such gruesome detail and it was kind of titillating for the reader. And I think that it really struck a chord to me when she said that, because I feel like that still goes on, not even just necessarily with violence against Black people, but just violence in general when it's reported on. And I've definitely read articles, like in Boston we have the Boston Metro, which is all news briefs, and I've seen them dedicate what seems like a really disproportionate amount of space to real serious details about things like rape. I've definitely seen that. Sexual assault to young women.
Right.
And so it definitely struck me when she said that. I think that goes on, and I think it makes me think that in the greater scheme of things, maybe we all need to write letters to papers and stuff when that still happens.
You've got to wonder, I agree, Rachel, at this news value, and I do believe that we have a culture that has learned to become entertained by violence and violence in sexual matters as well.
Mm.
And I wonder at the results of that in terms of our children, frankly, in terms of our own spirits.
Mm. And to the degree to which it has desensitized us and perhaps dehumanized us with the into the bargain. Rachel, thank you. Let's take a call from Matthew. Matthew, hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me on. Listen, I wanted to say it's really, I think, sad and tragic in a way that this kind of a discussion in the detail and the horribleness has to be made. But at the same time, I really respect you and thank you for bringing this kind of a subject to light. One of the things that I was looking at and just sort of thinking about as you were talking is the idea just recently in sort of the primetime media that there's been actually a show, it's called 6 Feet Under on HBO, that focuses on death, on a funeral home, and on a lot of different aspects of a family's life. But one of the things that I think is just fascinating is that, it's a huge hit, really, and it deals with this topic of death.
The death industry.
Exactly. Mm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And also the elements of comfort, mm-hmm. not only that the funeral home operators provide to the families and to, the relatives of the deceased, but also actually the comfort that the funeral home operators actually get in an incredible way from the spirits, from these sort of visitations, and they don't really go into mm. whether it is a
yeah.
visitation or
yeah.
not, but of the deceased themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does this echo with something you found in Black Morticians, Carol Holloway?
I've got to say that I've been watching the show myself, thinking about its connection to Passed On. Can't talk so much about the visitations, but I can certainly speak to the degree to which the Black Mortician thinks it's incredibly important to form that bond, or to nurture that bond, I should say, with the community. One of the differences with Black and white morticians is the Black mortician instantiates himself much more clearly as a community member, a member of the church. Sometimes the mortician and funeral and minister are both listed on the church bulletin board. And so that relationship with the community is a given. And that relationship, so when the community comes to the funeral home to be buried, actually sometimes that's where the difficulty of moving from a neighbor to a neighborly to a business transaction happens. And although it is, as your guest says, very, very important to nurture that relationship, I think it's also been the cause for some of the difficulty in terms of the end of the century survival of the Black funeral industry.
Yeah, we want to get to that and essentially the way in which white corporate America is now essentially burying lots of Black people at the expense of the Black funeral industry. Isn't that so?
That is true.
Yeah.
I've got to say one of the reasons I wrote the book was when I went to the first Black funeral and a white funeral home, and I knew what a difference that was for our community, and I wanted to think about what that meant.
Yeah.
But also, as you say, corporations are taking over Black funeral homes and fronting Black morticians in them, although they're owned by white folks.
Mm. We're talking about the Black way of death this hour on Point. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. We'll be right back. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about the African-American way of death this hour with Carla Holloway, author of Passed On, African-American Mourning Stories, a memorial, and our news analyst, Lewis Gordon, director of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Akif is on the line. Hello.
Hey, good evening there, Jack.
Good evening. Welcome.
Hey. I just have 2 points. The first, in initially when you opened up the show, you were mentioning lynchings, and you happened to say something about these lynchings of the South. And I just want to, I think we don't do ourselves any favor by thinking that that's not an atrocity that occurs throughout our nation. So, you know, and in the case of Mr. Till, you know, this is Chicago. So,
well, he was killed in Mississippi. But taken to Chicago. But we certainly take your point. And Carla Holloway, you've got a chart in here showing the distribution of lynchings. And a lot of the middle border states are in here. And I'm trying to figure if I'm...
That's right. Well, that's an early century chart. But and that's when the NAACP was keeping track of those lynchings. But I've got to agree with your caller, lynching. Mm-hmm. In terms of a definition, a killing by a mob of more than three people, I agree with her. It happens across this country.
I mean, even now, we aren't above and beyond it. We haven't really gotten that far yet, and that's sad. But I think a lot of times we just don't even hear about it. But to the point of your program, though, I do want to say that as a person not of color, I'm very inspired by the way the African-American community, friends of mine who embrace death and how they look at this turning point and a passing in their life. So it's very inspirational to myself, and it has an influence upon me. And it it is reminiscent of perhaps the Pentecostal embrace of and looking at death, or other evangelical faith that, you know, I know I have family members who have this very profound sense of coming to terms with this type of passing.
Yeah. Yes. Carla Holloway, could you describe for us the sort of classic African-American funeral and then maybe to say how it's changing under the sort of corporate influence?
I've got to say that's a wonderfully interesting phrasing. I haven't heard classic and African-American quite together like that. But and I have got to say, as you mentioned earlier, that the African-American funeral is louder, and to say that louder is relative. I like theorist Horton Spillers' use of the word passional. And so the African-American funeral that your listeners are thinking about and remembering and probably anticipating is a funeral where there is an expressive passion that vents the horror of the moment, that where the preacher has a duty to bring the family from a moment of grief to feeling that they can move forward from that moment. And that is a characteristically community moment. The church choir is involved. The church deaconesses are involved. The funeral directors themselves are passing out fans and hankies and making sure that mourners who are prostrate are both given their space and allowed to recover from the moment. And the important thing in many African American funerals of this classic variety is that the casket is open.
I should like to add to that the discussion focuses predominantly on African American Christians, but I should like to add that I've been to Black Muslim funerals, and also when one deals with funerals around Black Jews, there's something that is identified immediately as very different. And the what Professor Holloway brought up right away, right, was the question of the community's involvement. There's a sense in which in many white funerals it's personal, whereas with many African American funerals it's the community who's seeing the person off.
And what I've noticed in the African American funerals I've attended is the role of testimony. Someone from such a reserved culture as myself, I was just sort of surprised to see people just walk up to the pulpit and testify about the difference that the person made, the qualities of the person, anecdotes, funny stories, also sad stories, but trying to evoke the person who had died. And in this, it seemed to me, far from the Catholic funeral, which I'm not running down, but where the particular personhood of the dead person is assimilated to Jesus, to the cross, to that metaphor. And there's an impersonality about it. And I was just so warmed by the richness of the personal in these funerals.
I actually think that that's a tradition that pulls us back to a culture for whom narrative and telling a story has been particularly important. And this is a way, even in that formal moment of the funeral, of making a record in that sacred space of the church. And in saying that in that space, it gives a different kind of resonance and propriety to it. So you're right, the body is memorialized, and that record is written, spoken actually, into a history that the community can remember and pass on.
And of course, the funeral procession, you call it the show. Tell us about that.
Well, funeral directors that I spoke to almost invariably told me about how our people like to put on a good show. And the show is anything from making sure that there are enough cars in the funeral to indicate the importance of the life that has been lost. And so the number of cars, the quality of cars has been important in many African-American funerals. And the show means making sure that people can see and feel and get a good sense of the body that has passed on. And whether it is someone like Florence Mills' funeral in Harlem, the actress and singer in Shuffle Along, whose Blackbirds were released into the air. Mm. She had just starred in Blackbirds over in Europe and in the United States. It actually reminded me of the recent funeral of the singer Aaliyah, for whom I believe doves were sent into the air in a performance, a show of, you know, whether it's what they're dressed in the casket or what the casket itself is made of, including the kente cloth caskets that are on the market now. That dimension of the visual and the sensory is particularly important in these kinds of funerals that you're talking about. Although I also got to say, we're going for that classic funeral here, and certainly there are important differences.
Important differences now in the more corporate funeral, which isn't as enthusiastic and as the show isn't quite so pronounced. That sort of thing, you mean?
Well, I was very interested in the change of the black funeral mid-century on up towards the present day, where the wake starts at 12 o'clock in the church, and at 12:30 the funeral starts, and it's over at 1 o'clock so that people can get back to work. This is a sort of, and I know this is too informal, a sort of slam band, thank you, ma'am, funeral. And it's the kind that a sort of corporatist culture has pushed because of the busyness of our lives. Mm. But you also notice in the book that one of the things I talk about a lot is the amount of time that one takes in a funeral if we are to show appropriate respect. And that time that cannot be constrained by a clock is an indication that this is a life we are going to testify about no matter how late in the afternoon it's getting.
Hmm. Lewis Gordon?
Oh, no, I was just at the moment just listening to what you were saying, Professor Holloway. One of the things that struck me as well about African-American funerals is the meaning of an ancestor. Mm. And this is, again, something that connects African-America with Africa. I can think of a wonderful story of a closer friend whose father had died, but he could not give him the proper burial until much later when he could afford it. So what happened was they had to get the body, basically, and rebury this man. Mm-hmm. But in the process, the entire community was to show up, and the mother insisted that he purchases a cow. And she explained that the father needed to be properly honored because the father was now an ancestor. And in many ways, if we think of what the importance in a community of what an ancestor is, the idea that one is becoming an ancestor is something to celebrate.
The idea of ancestry forces us to ritual, because
correct,
these are the ways that we are going to remember the dead. And whether we are talking about West African funeral traditions passed on to the U.S., this idea of honoring the ancestors so that that spirit will feel comfortable being among the community, even as ancestor, is important. And I think you're absolutely right that the honor we do for the dead is a way to assure the presence of that ancestral spirit for guidance into the future.
And to show it a kind of transgrave respect, almost.
Oh, I don't believe the burial is a burial at all.
A going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the last moments at the grave. What can you give us just an image in closing of what that's like?
Well, one of the things that my research found is that those gravesite moments tell their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I'm not indicating so much what can happen at the gravesite, and funeral directors have included a lot of stories in there about some of the interesting both ceremonies and beliefs that people have about caskets being reused. They're not, or some families mm-hmm. damaging a casket to make sure they're not reused. But more important for me is what happens when you go back to see the memorials of African Americans who've died. And the last part of the book, of course, includes those photographs from grave sites for famous African Americans. And just as a body, if I can use that word, the difference in the way we have memorialized tells its own story, I think, of the century. The difference in the plaque in the ground for Malcolm X or the city block for Martin Luther King. These are not stories that stop at the gravesite.
Carla Holloway, thank you very much. Carla Holloway is the author of Passed On, African American Mourning Stories, a Memorial. She's Dean of Humanities at Duke University. And thank you, Lewis Gordon. Lewis Gordon is the director of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. What are your culture's death rituals? Follow the conversation into the diary. Earlier today, the FBI said it received a videotape containing evidence that Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl had been killed by his captors in Pakistan. President Bush, still in Beijing, recorded the following comments about the murder. Here are the president's remarks.
Laura and I and the American people are deeply saddened to learn about the loss of Daniel Pearl's life. And we're really sad for his wife and his parents and his friends and colleagues who have been clinging to hope for weeks that he'd be found alive. We're especially sad for his unborn child, who will now know his father only through the memory of others. All Americans are sad and angry to learn of the murder. All around the world, American journalists and humanitarian aid workers and diplomats and others do important work in places that are sometimes dangerous. Those who would threaten Americans, those who would engage in criminal, barbaric acts, need to know that these crimes only hurt their cause and only deepen the resolve of the United States of America to rid the world of these agents of terror. May God bless Daniel Pearl.
President Bush speaking earlier today in China about the murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.